Okay. As you might gather, it's a little disconcerting when something that you've assumed for your paper, namely that modern environmentalism is a religion, is taken on by the first author. I don't know whether I prefer to have Charles go in front of me or after me, but I am talking about kind of some of the aspects of environmentalism as religion. I would agree, at least in part, that it's a poorly formed religion, and it's a very secularized religion, and it's very political in nature. But at least it is a statement of how the world works, and it's a statement of what counts, and it's a statement of our relationship to nature. Now, that may be an ideology rather than a religion, but it certainly does get at the question that was asked at the last session: are all of the issues with regard to the environment answered by what we might call economic sorts of questions? And a lot of them are not. For instance, with regard to cost-benefit studies, if you're going to do cost-benefit studies, a big question is who counts? You know, who's going to be a part of this calculus? And that is either a religious question or a moral question or an ethical question, but it certainly is a question that goes beyond the economics, and I think we have to be prepared to answer that. Let me tell you that I do think there's at least a philosophical revolution going on, if not a religious revolution going on, with regard to how we think about nature and how we think about humankind and its relationship to nature. In my work with students, I would say that there's some things that I observe as a part of their ethos of how they think about the world. They're generally insistent that humankind is fundamentally at war with nature. They're deeply suspicious of modern technology and economic growth, and they are extremely uncomfortable with any ideological position that smacks of human dominion over nature. Now, some of those, in a sense, may be answerable by kind of technical sorts of issues about what does economic growth do, but there's also a worldview framework that at least starts you thinking about that. And, of course, the most popular framework now for thinking about these sorts of things is what could be called ecocentric or biocentric. It has not permeated into all parts of thinking, but it certainly is, I think, a very popular one, and it's starting to have even people that are not what you'd call ardent biocentrists are being influenced by it. And it really is, in the words of Sessions and Duvall, two of the leading biocentrists, the basic intuition that all organisms and entities in the ecosphere are equal in intrinsic worth. And again, I find a lot of people that buy into that. And of course, the big theme out of all of that is that anthropocentrism, a human-centered sort of a perspective, is really at fault. That if you have to try to figure out where the problem is, it's the anthropocentric view that has led to our environmental crisis, and we have to revise that if we are going to have a correct perspective on the environment. I think I may be engaging a bit in what Charlie was talking about, and that's at least a critique of that way of thinking, whether or how we want to regard the semantics of it, because I do find that there's some real problems with that, and I do think that calling it a religion, if that keeps us from critiquing it, then that's a problem. But I'll call it a religion, but I'm going to go ahead and critique it. I want to start with the argument that an anthropocentric view is appropriate. What I really want to do is to defend what I would kind of call an orthodox perspective in terms of a historical Judaism and historical Christianity as reasonable perspectives in how we can think about the environment, and that they give us a framework that I would say is theologically powerful and logically powerful and empirically powerful in terms of understanding the world. I would basically, and a lot of people have done this, is to take on Lynn White Jr. to argue that the Judaic Christian position is not narrowly anthropocentric in the sense of arguing that all value has to come from humans using the earth, that it leads to kind of a narrow utilitarianism. Cal has talked about some of the scripture passages that would grant worth to nature or dignity to the created order, and it seems to me that a correct reading of both the Jewish and the Christian scripture gives you that sort of an understanding of nature. So it is not a very narrow utilitarian sort of a perspective that says that the nature is only of worth because it satisfies human longings. It is of worth because God has declared it to be of worth. And appropriate dominion really does mean acting as responsible stewards of creation. Humans are creatures made in the image of God, which surely involves a respect and appreciation of nature. But I would like to also suggest that the attempts to move beyond anthropocentrism to a more eco or biocentric view run into a lot of other theological and logical problems. One indication of the failure of those trying to derive an ecocentric theology is the difficulty of agreeing on some stopping point for the rights of nature. Earlier efforts really concentrate on concepts such as sentience, but philosophers and theologians have really been unable to agree upon a workable definition that limits it to that. Edward Abbey, a leading deep ecologist, wrote, "Unless the need were urgent, I could no more sink the blade of an axe into the tissues of a living tree than I could drive it into the flesh of a human being." René Dubois, prominent bacteriologist, says that just as people and wolves should coexist, so should people and germs. But even if you grant the rights to living creatures, that doesn't solve the problem, since several leading figures in the deep ecology movement, in the words of Michael Cohen, would say, "Rocks and mountains, sand, clouds, wind and rain, all are alive. Nothing is dead." So you really don't have any sorts of categories that you can put things into that make much meaningful sense out of that. And I think that's obvious when you think about how the moral theory of biocentrism fits with kind of our common sense notions of right and wrong. I'm not suggesting that our morality should be subject to ratification by majority vote, but it does seem to me that sophisticated ethical theories should probably not fly in the face of what the person on the street thinks is right. And most humans do want to draw some distinction between the well-being of their child and that of the diphtheria bacterium that is competing with that child for life. The fact that even the most ardent fans of ecocentrism eat spinach salads and walk on grass should also reveal something about the internal consistency of a claim that, again, in the words of leading biocentrists, all things in the biosphere have an equal right to live and to blossom and to reach their own individual forms of unfolding and self-realization. I find it almost impossible to make any sort of a workable framework for understanding the world, the environment, out of statements like that. But perhaps more fundamentally, my bigger problem with those sorts of attacks on anthropocentrism is that every call for action with regard to the environment is a call that is anthropocentric and that is predicated upon humans doing something. We are asked to respond to stories of environmental disaster, to evidence that nature is being altered in unfortunate ways, to appeals to alter the damage that humans are doing. Every one of these is a call to change, and it is humans that are being asked to change. These appeals presuppose that humans are the reasoning creatures of the universe and the ones that respond to moral arguments. This is a view, very human-centered perspective, and one that depends upon a human-centered view of how the world works. In fact, it's unclear to me how people that conceive of a biocentric perspective can have anything but really an anthropocentric perspective. Those who call for a recognition of the rights of nature are suggesting that humans, through their thought processes or through their actions, recognize those rights. If there really are rights that are embodied in trees or in rocks, they're only meaningful in our world because humans choose to recognize them. Any rights that have significance in terms of human institutions will be conceived of and acted upon by humans, and it's really difficult to see how we can have any meaningful policies or ideologies that have any practical impact on nature unless they are seen through human eyes. Lawrence Tribe of Harvard has suggested that we should choose, quote, processes which avoid a premise of human domination, end of quote. But the very process through which Tribe chooses to express the rights of nature, namely the legal system, has no way of removing human domination. In fact, the claims he makes for nature to have rights independent of any human influence are really claims that particular people or groups who have certain views about nature should be given special voice, and others with different views should have less influence. Tribe and other supposed ecocentrists are really making arguments about human claims, which are interesting ones and need to be treated, but they are claims about which human claims should have precedence. Once one recognizes that there is no realistic way in which nature can speak for itself, one is left with the question of who does speak for nature. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gary Snyder has suggested that poets are uniquely positioned to hear voices from trees. That doesn't tell us what happens if the poets disagree. The anthropocentric view also resolves another contradiction in human environmental theology. Such theology treats nature and all natural processes as good, but condemns humans when they act in their own self-interest in a way that is natural. In the natural order, one species cannot be asked to accept responsibility for the survival of another species. However, in an anthropocentric order, one can request that responsibility of the human species. Humans can be held morally accountable for their actions, and this accountability is really a reflection of the human-centered nature of our political system and our political philosophy. That also, the Judeo-Christian position also has another important aspect, and that, of course, is the relation of the creator and the created. The Judeo-Christian position sees the natural order as reflecting God's handiwork, but that's not the full measure of God. One can see evidence of him in creation, but one does not worship the creation itself. In contrast, much of the modern environmental theology sees the natural order as the actual embodiment of God, or sees nature as representing all that is good. And I would agree again with Charles that it's not a very religious form of religion at many times. But the implication of this perspective is that humankind is less than natural, and everything that humans do to alter nature is a move from the perfect to the less perfect. In contrast, if one views both nature and humans as imperfect, as the Judeo-Christian tradition does, there's a creative role for humankind to play in interacting with nature. Furthermore, not all human action with respect to nature is categorically evil. Even though physical resources are limited in this world, and Cal made this point quite well, the thoughtful application of creative effort by humans can keep those limitations from impinging upon us. This perspective does not automatically condemn economic growth as evil, nor all technological change as a force that desecrates the perfect natural order. Biblical theology sees no reason to exalt nature over humankind. We can capture a glimpse of the glory of God in a flower, or in a mountain stream, or in a symphony. Creative acts by humankind are just as much a part of God's plan and bring glory to him in the same way that the natural environment does. Likewise, human relationships, a father holding his son's hand as they walk through a park, the joy of a family reunion, the bliss of a happy marriage, those also represent God's good work on this earth. This is really in sharp contrast to environmental theology that argues that only in a state of nature is true happiness realized and that all human activities are of secondary importance. Let me turn to another question, and that's really the issue of scientific inquiry and the search for truth. One of the interesting aspects of modern environmentalism is how susceptible many in the movement are to ecological hysteria. And we've had lots of evidence of that last night and today about all of the ways in which people have responded to kind of non-facts or poorly constructed sorts of facts. I wouldn't want to say that this susceptibility is entirely due to religious sentiments, but I do think that the new environmental theologies have had an impact. Since these theologies are nature-centered, their proponents tend to react with religious fervor to anything that alters nature. Because these beliefs see nothing outside of nature that offers any eternal hope, any threat to nature is seen as a threat to God. Hence, attempts to deal carefully with issues of fact about environmental issues are dismissed as hyper-rational and inappropriate. If you know by virtue of divine revelation that nature is endangered by human action, then all of modern technology is suspect. Herbicides and pesticides are, by their very nature, an unwarranted alteration of the natural order. The burning of fossil fuels or the construction of a high-voltage power line represents the hubris of modern civilization. And when these technologies are charged with fouling the environment or threatening human health, it's really easy to believe that such charges. From this perspective, our salvation as a race lies in our returning to harmony with nature, and arguments that modern technology is evil incarnate are not even questioned. The Judeo-Christian position is much more sanguine about modern technology for several reasons. First, since these religions believe in a universe in which order is discoverable by human reason, thoughtful use of the mind is seen as an appropriate activity. Questions of fact about the impact of various technologies are important issues, and careful pursuit of truth by trained scientists is crucial to resolving those questions. The Judeo-Christian position implies an obligation, basically careful, responsible study of the issues. Secondly, because the ultimate reality for Jews and Christians does not lie in this world, I would argue that they can be less emotionally involved in debates about the environmental impact of certain measures. Nature does not represent all that is real and meaningful, and thus it is really easier to deal more dispassionately with issues concerning it. And finally, let me turn to the question of kind of utopianism and trade-offs. What does all this mean for the public policy debate over environmental issues? Modern environmental theology implies that if only people will adopt an appropriate perspective with regard to nature, then environmental problems, and all other problems, will end. Unity with nature will bring humans into perfect harmony with the world around them, and thus eliminate the need for any concern about appropriate institutional structures. It has, of course, the sound or the smacks of the Marxist remaking of the person. Charles Reich, in his 1970 book, says there's a revolution coming. Its ultimate creation will be a new and enduring wholeness and beauty, a renewed relationship of man to himself, to other men, to society, to nature, and to the land. In contrast, I would argue that both Judaism and Christianity are non-utopian. They do not rely entirely upon religious reformation to make the world better. Commitment to their theology does not solve all the problems of human frailty. Both understand that humans, even religious humans, will lack adequate information about the world around them to make sound judgments with, and will still often lapse into sin and act in ways that are neither good for them nor their fellow human creatures. Thus, the Judeo-Christian position sees ample room for human institutions that will channel human activity in socially productive directions. The Judeo-Christian position allows, even encourages, human creativity in designing institutions that improve human interactions and protect, when appropriate, environmental quality. The Judeo-Christian position also differs from much modern environmental theology in that it sees a whole host of goals to which humans can aspire. Rather than the preservation of nature is the only end, other ends are also worthy of our attention. The reduction of poverty, the creation of societal conditions so all humans can live in dignity, the promotion of a political regime that allows for liberty, and numerous other goals are to be striven for. But when a multiplicity of goals exists, choices must be made, and the careful application of human reason is necessary to adjudicate between sometimes conflicting ends. And I would suggest that it's in that context that the institutional framework looms large. It's not simply enough to get people to think right about the environment, but we must also have a system of rules. In the last session, there was some discussion of that. I would call those property rights that hold people accountable and which allows for appropriate trade-offs among various goals. Because most environmental theology has evolved with the sole purpose of saving nature, there's little recognition of the necessity of good institutional design, nor is there any discussion of competing goals. Rather, human actions are almost always characterized as simply right or wrong, with the basis for judgment being the impact on the environment. And then finally, in conclusion, I would suggest that because Judaism and Christianity recognize a multiplicity of human goals, ultimate goal, of course, being, and the ultimate object of human life being to glorify God, but beyond that, there is a room in these theologies for the changing of the ranking of goals over time. Modern environmentalists may not like it, but it's hard to dispute that much of the recent environmental consciousness has developed because of rising incomes and growing opportunities. People can now afford to be concerned about the environment because they're no longer struggling to maintain a bare subsistence. The wilderness is no longer a foe that stands in the way of our survival and thus needs to be conquered. It's now a haven for the harried urbanite. The Judeo-Christian position does not require reworking to accommodate such changes. There's vast amount of room for different subjective evaluations among individuals as to what is important, and these evaluations can change over time, as long as the ultimate concept is correct. Because the ultimate meaning of life is determined by one's relationship with God, the temporal world and one's perception of the values of its various components can change dramatically without the necessity of altering one's basic theology. In contrast, the new religions of the environment have been developed with the sole purpose of saving the natural order. No alteration of the ranking of goals can occur without a whole new theology. So even though these new religions seem to be offering a definitive theological statement that is supposed to endure, they may prove to be quite transitory in the face of changing values and aspirations. And I would just suggest that this is one more reason why Jews and Christians can be very forthright in defending the relevance of their faith to environmental concerns.